Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Christy Funk. Christy Funk, MD, is a board-certified breast cancer surgeon and physician, and she's the best-selling author of Breasts, an Owner's Manual. Dr. Funk practices as a breast surgeon at the Pink Lotus Breast Center in Los Angeles, where she excels as an expert in minimally invasive diagnostic and treatment methods for all types of breast disease. She's helped thousands of women through breast cancer treatment, including well-known celebrities like Angelina Jolie and Sheryl Crow. Dr. Funk hosts the Cancer Kicking Powwow video podcast, the annual Cancer Kicking Summit, and she's an avid contributor to Pink Lotus Power Up, which is a worldwide community of women who are passionate about women's health. Her research and work have led her to advocate for a healthy diet and lifestyle to maximally reduce your risks of cancer and all killer diseases. She wants to keep you healthy, well, and out of the operating room. So now, Christy, my dad and I are thrilled to have this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad and colleague, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that introduction. And mostly, thank you, Christy, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you both. It's so fun to be here, always.
Always, it is. Ocean's just mentioned your wonderful book, Breasts, an Owner's Manual. And also mentioned that Sheryl Crow, who actually wrote the foreword to your book. And in her foreword, Sheryl wrote that knowing you as well as she does, she knows that every time you have to tell a patient that a cancer screening has found a malignancy, it feels like a blow, not only to the patient, but also to you. And Christy, having read your book and having had the privilege of spending time with you, I have the sense that you would love nothing better than to put yourself out of a job as a surgeon by helping women to prevent breast cancer in the first place. So what I want to ask you to start with is, what has led you to be as focused on prevention as you are?
Wow, what a great question, because this has been an evolutionary process since I first went into medical school. I have had a longstanding focus on diet and health and fitness. I've always been athletic, but I was definitely falling prey to the dietary fads of the day. For example, when I was in residency, all of us kind of gained 10 plus pounds just being so busy and sedentary and not really taking care of ourselves. And I challenged everybody to what was so in vogue at the time, which was the Atkins diet. And at the end of the day, a month went by. It was a one-month challenge, and most people dropped out, but five of us stuck with it. And as tragedy would have it, I was vegetarian at that point. But because I couldn't eat all of my fruits and vegetables and stick to the Atkins, I actually added back cheese and chicken and turkey and fish. And that's when I stopped being vegetarian, was in a crusade to lose weight and get healthier, of all ironies. But at the end of this month, three of the guys had lost between 10 and 40 pounds, and I had gained 3. So it totally backfired on me. But despite thinking I knew about diet and nutrition, I didn't until I dove into the nutritional science to write my book, Breasts, the Owner's Manual. And it was that pivotal turning that brought me into what you term prevention. I like to call it maximal risk reduction, just because of knowing that there's a little bit of hubris in thinking that we humans can truly prevent anything with certainty, but we can maximally reduce all risks. And that was the biggest turning point. So it was relatively recently that I became so overly passionate about risk reduction, rather than waiting until this cancer moment occurred. And people now were, okay, reducing risk, but what they're really reducing is recurrence risk and the risk of death from this known cancer. I'd like to push us, rewind 20 years and get on the front end so that fateful day never happens.
Polls show that less than a quarter of American women are aware that there are any dietary steps that they can take that would lower their risks, their chances of developing breast cancer. And among American women with less than a high school education, only 3% are aware that what they eat has any effect whatsoever on their breast cancer risk. Christy, would you say that one of the most dangerous falsehoods circulating in our society and perhaps circulating in our medical system as well is that your diet doesn't impact breast health?
John, I think that is the biggest lie propagated by the billions of dollars in industry money that stand to get lost if the lie comes to light. And the medical professionals don't know any better. The women fall into the same stats you just said. So a quarter of female physicians would probably say that your diet matters, and the other 75% would be like, huh, it does? So the physicians are not at fault per se, as the educational system has failed them. It has failed to even discuss the importance of nutrition. Now, these physicians may have failed themselves and then therefore their patient populations by not self-educating, but that's a tall order, right? We go through enough education. You'd think we'd come out knowing everything we were, quote unquote, supposed to know to do our jobs well. What I love, ironically, about this lie is that it's so massive that if we could shed light on it, lives would be transformed in a matter of literally weeks. We have scientific studies that show that a turn toward healthier eating, whole food, plant-based, minimizing, eliminating alcohol, exercising regularly, striving toward an ideal body weight, all of these actions just sustained for a mere 2 to 3 weeks will literally transform your blood into a cancer-fighting machine, heightening the immune system and altering hundreds. We've seen in studies about 450 genes that will get automatically regulated, with the bad ones shutting off and the good ones flipping on, just by a change in the lifestyle. You don't have to wait 10 years to be a perfectly robust, toned, ideal body weight, totally 100 plant-based perfection of a turnaround. You just need to start taking those steps, and your body and your immune system and all the cellular processes will follow in pursuit. So imagine if we can just get the word out. There's so much to be done. The opposite would be terrible. If it really were that cancer and all of our killer diseases like diabetes and Alzheimer's and heart disease and stroke were up to fate and up to our genetic predisposition, our inherited genes from mom and dad. Because if that were true, there'd be very little room for improvement. But on the flip side, we have so many people we can reach and lighten, and they can embark on this path, and their lives will never be the same, and they will be so much healthier for it.
Well, I hear you talking about empowerment, basically, giving people the knowledge that there are steps they can take that will reduce, in a woman's case, her breast cancer risk in achievable and dramatic ways, and that this is all backed up by rigorous scientific research. And this strikes me as very important information for all of us, and particularly women, to have. And at the same time, Christy, I don't think anybody wants to make cancer patients, people who have developed cancer already, feel guilty for somehow causing their disease. Now, I know that most of your patients who heed your advice do feel empowered, and they feel relieved, and they appreciate knowing what they can do. But what I want to ask you is, when you're treating a woman who has breast cancer, how do you help her to understand the power of her food and her lifestyle choices without risking making her feel guilty for whatever choices she may have made in the past?
I think the easiest way to make women feel like I'm coming from a place of love and a deep desire to empower them and to improve their future life and health, and in the immediate moment to cure this cancer and make sure it never comes back, is simply by being very transparent with, like, how could you know? How could you have known? If your doctor doesn't know and tell you, how are you supposed to know? If all of the advertisement all bombarding you from billboards to TV to your pop-up ads is telling you the exact opposite of what I'm about to share with you when it comes to food and nutrition, how are you supposed to know? But now this cancer, it came here not to kill you, but to change you. And one of the biggest changes we can make is what we're doing 3 to 6 times a day, lifting fork to mouth. So let's dive in. Let me teach you a few things. And then I start talking about how the cellular response to animal protein and animal fat is everything that cancer requires and desires to feed and fuel itself so it can multiply and divide and eventually metastasize and threaten your life. And at the same time, then we have the empowering news about plants. It's not just that animal food is deleterious to you. It's, wow, the power of plants. And you get excited suddenly about a bunch of kale.
You were talking about how could women know? I mean, if they haven't been told by their doctors, if the culture as a whole is pervasive with the idea that dietary lifestyle you live doesn't affect your cancer risk, and then you get cancer, and then you find out that it did actually affect it, you know, that can be a confronting thing for people. And then you said, well, but how could you know, given the extent of the blindness and the obliviousness that pervades our society and our medical system? Mm-hmm. And I know that you also, you said that you believed certain things at one time because that was the prevailing ideas. I want to ask you about soy foods. There's a lot of controversy about soy foods, and particularly due to the compounds in soy that can bind to estrogen receptors. And some people are concerned that even moderate amounts of soy could increase the risk of breast cancer, especially if their cancer is estrogen receptor positive. Christy, can you set the record straight about soy?
Oh, I'd love to. So here's what it comes down to. We didn't understand until the early 2000s that there were actually two different estrogen receptors in our bodies and on different organs, or sometimes organs can have a mixture, but there's alpha and beta. Now, breast cancer has alpha receptors. 80% of all breast cancers are fed and fueled by estrogen when it hits that alpha receptor and tells the cancer to multiply and divide. Except the phytoestrogens, the isoflavones like genistein in soy, with 1,600% more affinity, hit the beta receptors in our bodies. Okay, so now what do they do there? Two fascinating things. Number one, beta shuts alpha down. So soy effectively acts like tamoxifen, knocking or blocking the alpha receptor on those breast cancers. And number two, when the beta receptor is activated by soy, it sends a signal that goes to the fat cells. Everywhere you have a fat cell, you have an enzyme called aromatase. Aromatase is busy churning away other steroids from your adrenal gland, which you're not going to ever get rid of, like testosterone and androstenedione, and making them into estrogen. Aha, that's why women after menopause can have high levels of circulating estrogen, especially if they're overweight or obese. More fat, more aromatase, more conversion to estrogen. Not enough to stop hot flashes or make you fertile, but certainly enough estrogen to feed and fuel all those postmenopausal breast cancers. So back to soy. It shuts alpha receptors down and it goes to your fat and shuts down that enzyme, effectively lowering the estrogen levels. So until 2009, we were looking at mice and petri dishes. And admittedly, some of those studies, they say you graft a mouse with a breast cancer, you feed it a bunch of soy, and lo and behold, in 10% of the mice, the cancers grew. What? Well, we don't know what it's doing to you. Spit the miso out of your mouth, woman. Like, you can't have soy. But beginning in 2009, we now have over 10 excellent quality human studies in soy, and unequivocally, every single study shows a positive association between soy and a reduction in breast cancer, always to the tune of, for high versus low consumers of soy. And honestly, some of these high, quote unquote high groups, we're talking 1.5 servings a week, a cup and a half of soy milk a week. And these high versus low or no consumers would have 30 to 60% less breast cancer. And once they got breast cancer, they had 30 to 60% less recurrence and 30% less death. In fact, the most recent study that has come out was just in 2020, and it looked at soy versus dairy milk and all dairy. And it was 52,000 North American women who were initially free of breast cancer. They were followed for 7.9 years. And interestingly, we've got 30% of the population being Black, which I like because they're often an underrepresented study group cohort. And in that 8 years, about 1,060 new breast cancers happened. And now they analyze the cancers in terms of dairy intake. Total dairy, like milk, butter, cheese, cream, et cetera, had a 22% increase in breast cancer versus lower intakes. But what was really interesting was when you compared the 90th to 10th, so the very most versus the least consumers of dairy milk, there was a 50% increase in breast cancer. But then when you looked at the median intake, so your just average amount of milk, dairy, versus those who only drank soy, boom, there comes that same number I see over and over again, 32% less breast cancer in soy milk consumers. So soy is not only neutral, it's actually protective against getting breast cancer in the first place and having it recur and dying from it once diagnosed.
I think that the role that soy can play in a healthy lifestyle and in a healthy eating path has sometimes been underestimated because we've had this kind of anti-soy backlash in the culture where the belief has been propagated that soy contributes to cancer. Do you have any idea where that comes from or why we've gotten into that wrong thinking?
I think there are two main reasons. One is the dairy industry. It is a massive industry threatened by soy milk, right? And the other is that the data in petri dishes and mice was a little contradictory, and you actually could see breast cancer potentially stimulated by soy products, but it was in mice. And it turns out that women aren't mice. And until we had the human studies, which hit the research literature beginning in 2009, we weren't entirely sure if it were truly a safe food to be consuming. And indeed it is. Some of these studies would just blow your mind. And it's, you know what? It's interesting. It's not just estrogen in soy. Soy has such powerful anti-inflammatory, anti-carcinogenic powers that it dramatically reduces estrogen negative cancers in these human studies. There was one of the largest followed 6,200 multi-ethnic breast cancer survivors for 9.4 years. This is a study that came out in 2017, and there was a 51% drop in death from estrogen negative breast cancer and a 32% drop in death for estrogen positive. So soy is so multifaceted. It's not even just the isoflavones that are giving it its anti-cancer powers.
Well, that's a wonderful thing to know. And, you know, the dairy industry does not want people to think ill of their products. They want to sell as many of them to us as possible. But there keep being studies that suggest or indicate or even document, prove that dairy products aren't what the dairy industry would like us to think in terms of their effect on our health. And I'm thinking in particular of a study. It was published about 7 years ago. It was done by Kaiser Permanente researchers, and it appeared first in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. So it's a very, very comprehensive and compelling study. They looked at women who had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and they found that during the 12 years of the study, those women who ate one or more servings a day of any high-fat dairy product, cheese, whole milk, ice cream, had a 64% higher risk of dying compared to women who had less than half a serving a day. So what I want to ask you, Christy, is, I mean, we've known that high-fat dairy products have become notorious for their contributions to heart disease. Are they also now implicated in the development of breast cancer?
Turns out low-fat dairy doesn't seem to pose as many or any breast problems as the research might suggest. But the saturated fat in full-fat dairy definitely raises your eyebrows. And the study you quoted is certainly one of them pointing us in that direction of raising eyebrows. There's another one that looks at the consumption of butter and lard on a daily basis for those who have already had a breast cancer diagnosis. And there is a 67% increase in cancer recurrence for the highest third of fat consumers versus lowest third for butter and lard and margarine actually on a daily basis. But get this, there's a 212% increase in death for the highest versus lowest consumers of butter, margarine, and lard on a daily basis. So there is this connection between high fat dairy and breast cancer, and it seems to be residing in the fact of how this milk exists in the first place. These dairy cows are not like their pasture-fed buddies that had acres and acres to themselves from years ago. They are much more literally genetically modified to create high amounts of milk. The number of milk cattle in America in the 1920s and 30s and 40s was somewhere around 25 million cows. And now we're down to 8 million or thereabouts. And yet, at the very same time, the U.S. milk production has gone from, in the 1920s, around 80 pounds of milk to 220 pounds of milk per cow. So it's pretty interesting that the number of cows has gone down, but the milk production has skyrocketed. And the only way to answer that is, you figured it out, the milk production per cow has skyrocketed. So they've gone from annually something like 5,000 pounds to making 22,000 pounds of milk per cow. It's insane. And what it is that the cows are genetically modified, like I said, but they continuously produce milk throughout their pregnancy and actually throughout their entire lives because they are re-inseminated shortly after bringing a calf into the world. And so they're basically constantly pregnant, which every woman knows is a high estrogenic state. And where does that estrogen reside in the cow? In the fat. So full fat dairy possibly helps now explain this cancer mortality bump in the high consumers of dairy, which would include butter and cheese and ice cream and cream cheese and the like.
Well, if you were going to design an optimally healthy anti-cancer diet, would it include any dairy products?
No, absolutely not. Whatever healthful benefits you might derive from dairy, like calcium and vitamin D, you can absolutely get from your fruits, veggies, legumes, and whole grains. So the negative effects of dairy will always trump the positive.
Well, that's good to know. And, you know, a substantial part of your book, Breasts and Owner's Manual, is devoted to helping women to reduce their risk of breast cancer through making wiser food choices. And you have a list of the 10 breast superfoods, and it starts with cruciferous vegetables and leafy greens. And cruciferous veggies, of course, are those in the cabbage family. And that includes broccoli and kale and collards and arugula and mustard greens and bok choy and many others. And one of the reasons that these particular veggies are so protective against cancer is the isothiocyanates that they contain. And the superstar of all the isothiocyanates is sulforaphane. Christy, what do people need to know about sulforaphane and about the anti-cancer power of the veggies in the cabbage family?
Oh my gosh, I get so excited about sulforaphane that it becomes a little bit embarrassing, I think, as my kids would say, cringy. Mom, you're being cringy. But I'll tell you, I'm so blown away by the power of sulforaphane. Predominantly, it's in always in these cruciferous vegetables. Broccoli sprouts contain 100 times the sulforaphane as a broccoli floret, but it's all good and powerful. A couple of big things I want to share with you. One is that it takes an enzyme in the cell wall called myrosinase to mix when you chomp on that little broccoli floret, mixes with the isothiocyanate and turns it into sulforaphane, which was not naturally just sitting in the plant until you chomp down that cell wall, release the enzyme, and allowed it to do its tying on that little green superhero cape onto the isothiocyanate, turning it into sulforaphane with all the superpower to seek out and destroy cancer cells. Now, myrosinase gets destroyed by heat and cooking. So one of the secret weapons I always give people who tell me that roasted broccoli is their favorite food on planet Earth, and now you're telling me even broccoli roasted isn't good for me. Oh, no, back that up. Roasted broccoli is fantastic for you. Roast away. And here are the tricks you can employ. Just chop up a little bit of the raw broccoli and sprinkle it over your roasted. You're actually sprinkling the myrosinase back into action to get full benefit from all your roasted broccoli. Mustard seed will also contain the same enzyme, myrosinase. So you can throw a little whole grain mustard onto your dish, or just a pinch will do it of actual mustard powder. Now, listen to this. There's a couple of things I want to share about the power just translated into real life. One is a lab and one is real life. So real life, the Women's Healthy Eating and Living Study, the WHEAL study, 3,080 breast cancer patients, randomized controlled trial looking at the effectiveness of a high vegetable, low fat diet. And just 2 years after diagnosis, there was a 31% drop in recurrence for the highest third versus lowest third of cruciferous vegetable intake. And if you were also taking tamoxifen for your estrogen-driven breast cancer, and you were in the highest third of vegetable consumers, cruciferous vegetable consumers, 52% drop in recurrence. Stem cells have all these qualities, right? They can migrate, colonize, proliferate, self-renew. They're basically immortal. So what would happen if they, Darth Vader, what would happen if they went to the dark side and became a cancer stem cell, right? These can be used against us when they go bad. This study that I'm referring to took stem cells, breast cancer stem cells grafted into mice, both estrogen-driven and estrogen-negative. Estrogen-negative is our most fiercest adversary when it comes to treating and curing breast cancer. And they used quantities of sulforaphane that you would get from eating 1 1/4 cups of broccoli sprouts a day and fed it to these mice. And over a period of 3 weeks, the stem cells went from big and proliferative to going, 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 gone. That's the power of broccoli, to take the biggest, baddest epicenter, heart of it all cancer cell, and made it disappear in a matter of weeks just because of sulforaphane.
And that was from broccoli sprouts, which are the most concentrated form of sulforaphane available to us.
Right.
I actually grow broccoli sprouts in our home. We grow broccoli sprouts in the kitchen on a daily basis because we've been so impressed with the benefits of sulforaphane and the high concentrations of them found uniquely in broccoli sprouts.
How do you grow them?
We get the seeds for growing, get organic seeds and soak them overnight and then put them in a glass quart jar with a particular type of lid that's made for sprouting. So you can get that from almost any online. They're very, very inexpensive and simple. And they're just a lid that goes over it so that you can then rinse the sprouts each day several times. That keeps them moist, but they also drain so that they're not too moist and they grow. And in a few days, it's amazing. 4 or 5 days, you've gone from a small amount of seeds to a big quart jar full of broccoli sprouts.
Well,
and they're delicious.
My friend is, I always thought things like that are a little too much hassle than they're worth. But knowing that my little broccoli sprout tiny container is, $3, I think I'll start sprouting my own. Thank you, John.
For people who live in food deserts or places where it's harder to get fresh foods or fresh foods at their peak of their ripeness or for any other reason have difficulty, you can grow them at home and you don't need anything but the seeds, which of course are easy to get online. And the nutrient profile is just exquisite.
I love it.
I want to ask you about mushrooms, Christy, if I can. Mushrooms contain estrogen-blocking compounds. They contain aromatase inhibitors, which is one of the reasons that some people consider them to be potent anti-cancer foods for both men and women, by the way. In men, they keep testosterone and other androgens from being converted into estrogens by the aromatase, and thus they improve testosterone levels in older men, which most older men would appreciate. Christy, if you were, again, I'm asking, if you were designing the ultimate anti-cancer diet, would you include mushrooms and would you include all kinds of them or just the fancier, more expensive types?
I would absolutely include mushrooms for the reason that you gave. It is an aromatase inhibitor. We've described that enzyme as that one in fat cells that you said converts things like testosterone and other adrenal gland hormones into estrogen. And in fact, this has been studied in Chinese women, that a daily intake of 10 grams of mushroom. Okay, so most of us don't think of mushrooms in grams. So what am I talking about? A half of one cheapo button mushroom. That's what we're talking about. A half of a little white button mushroom dropped breast cancer rates in Chinese women by 64% compared with age-matched no mushroom eaters. And by 89% when they sipped on just a half cup of green tea to boot. So we could talk about the benefits of green tea, but you know, some of these fancier, expensive mushrooms, portobello, chanterelle, oyster, etc., they actually have fewer flavones and isoflavones, the plant-based phytoestrogens, than the little old white button. So you don't have to think you're being cheap. You're actually being more cancer protective when you're going for just the white mushroom.
Well, that's good to know. You know, you mentioned green tea. What is it about green tea that makes it so helpful against cancer?
So the phytochemical, the phytonutrient in green tea that makes it so powerful against both the production, invasion, and metastasis of breast cancer is called EGCG, epigallocatechin gallate. And it is just a little mastermind at taking away what cancer requires to thrive. In fact, what we haven't detailed out in our conversation today is just what all of these plants are doing. So phyto, meaning plant, chemical, meaning a structure that works inside your body to affect a certain action downstream. These phyto plant-based chemicals literally get inside your cells, bathing every single one of your cells. When it comes from plants, they're doing all of the things that boost your immune system to heighten its ability to seek out, attack, and destroy cells that have gone awry or over to the dark side. So we've just described how mushrooms lower estrogen. Cruciferous vegetables lower estrogen, and soy being one of the biggest that lowers estrogen. We lower what is fueling 80% of all breast cancers. We decrease growth hormone, in particular IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor, which is the biggest growth promoter screaming at cancer cells to divide and spread. We lower inflammation. We lower angiogenesis, the birth of new blood vessels, which every single cancer requires. Angiogenesis, the production of new blood vessels, if it wants to grow beyond the size of the tip of a ballpoint pen. And plants squelch those little literal arteries that bring nutrients and then create highways, exit ways straight to lung, liver, brain, or bone for metastases. So eating plants, eating phytochemicals creates a process inside your body that maximally promotes health. On the flip side, you chomp down on a little organic chicken breast, and boom, the opposite happens. Estrogen skyrockets, growth hormone, IGF-1 goes up, inflammation goes up, angiogenesis, blood vessels start rushing in to nourish those cancer cells. So you choose. Every time you lift fork to mouth, every time you chew and swallow, you are ultimately putting chemicals into that little bathtub that every single one of your cells is bathing in. So do you want the bath to be pro-cancer or anti-cancer? Please choose anti-cancer.
And when you do that, when you choose a healthy whole foods plant-based diet with that's rich in phytonutrients and all the wonderful substances that plants have that animal products don't, that our bodies need to be maximally healthy, you're doing something amazing. You are dramatically lowering your breast cancer risk, and that is wonderful. But at the same time, and this is important, I think, too, you're producing lower cholesterol, better triglycerides, lower blood pressure. You're going to have fewer heart attacks. You're going to have a leaner body and less diabetes. You're going to have more supple joints, healthier skin, better energy, better sleep, a happier mood, a sharper mind. You're going to have less dementia. You're going to have more regular bowel movements. You're going to have cleaner lungs. You're going to have a healthier planet. You're going to have a longer life. You're going to be happy with your life and love it more. I think this is wonderful. That the same food and lifestyle practices that you're proposing to lower breast cancer risk have so many other benefits.
Absolutely. All of those things, you just get such a boost of happiness and joy and health in your life that you can implement this new eating style with ease and with joy and with desire and never look back. But unfortunately, so many people are enslaved by traditions, family traditions, cultural traditions, and they actually get trapped into thinking, oh, everybody in my family's fat. Oh, everybody has high blood pressure and dies of a heart attack in their 60s. That's just how it goes. It's not true. These things that people mistakenly think are genetic or quote unquote run in the family, it's the lifestyle and the food choices that are more likely to, quote, run in the family, that run us straight into obesity and diabetes and heart attacks and strokes and Alzheimer's. And if we can break with that, quote, unquote, tradition, but not with all the emotions it brings with it. We're not trying to break from familial love and togetherness and connectivity. But if we break with the saturated fat and the refined sugars and all of the animal proteins, we just might burst into our best life yet.
We might. And a lot of women, though, still are believing that family history and genetics determine who gets breast cancer and who doesn't. And there are some cases, and Angelina Jolie, of course, is uniquely known for this, where family history and genetics are extremely significant. But I remember you telling me that 87% of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer do not have a single first-degree relative with breast cancer. This means that 87% of women who get breast cancer don't have a mother and don't have a sister who has had the disease. And yet when we go to see physicians, we're almost always asked about our family medical history. And we're asked whether our parents or our siblings have had this or that disease, but we're almost never asked about our diets.
We aren't. And it's unfortunate because diet has so much power, even in a genetic mutation carrier, to alter cellular metabolism and genetic pathways, whether the good ones are on or off. And physicians just don't have the training and the knowledge to understand how that should be de facto question number one. It's easier to also look at a family history and say, that's suspicious. Let's do a genetic test. Let's look for BRCA or these other gene mutations that run in the family, potentially for colorectal cancer or pancreatic, et cetera. It's so concrete and objective. It doesn't require any changes be made on the part of the patient. And unfortunately, right? And unfortunately, it's a journey, lifelong one, maybe one fraught with some serious struggle in the beginning for certain people to embrace a totally different life that espouses whole food, plant-based eating and maintaining an ideal body weight, minimizing alcohol and exercising regularly. And that level of hand-holding, there's no reimbursement for it in the medical field. I mean, that's the sad truth. Where's the money in helping you understand the power of broccoli? The broccoli industry is not going to promote it or pay for studies. Broccoli goes bad in a week. But Twinkies, now they last.
Well, the alcohol industry is enormously potent. And you just mentioned limiting alcohol as one of the critical lifestyle steps to reduce your risk of breast cancer and achieve optimal health. But there's a widely believed idea, and I want to ask you about this, Christy. The idea being that moderate amounts of alcohol, particularly red wine, are healthful. Christy, my read of the literature tells me that actually even relatively small amounts of alcohol can increase cancer risk. What's the truth about the role of alcohol in breast cancer risk?
The truth is that alcohol is a carcinogen. Even the IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer, places it in our quote-unquote absolutely carcinogenic to humans list, right there along processed meat and asbestos and tobacco smoke. So it specifically relates to breast cancer in that alcohol increases estrogen levels. It impairs the immune system. It forms acetaldehyde, which is a potent carcinogen. Even if you just swished and spit, you already make it in your mouth and swallow it down. But one of the main drivers, it seems, is that it inactivates the conversion of folate from your leafy greens and beans or folic acid from a multi. And it can't turn those into methylfolate, which is the activated form of folic acid that goes around and fixes DNA or sort of babysits the dividing DNA And so when DNA goes awry, it mutates. You don't have your methylfolate to fix the situation. So alcohol interferes with that enzyme called MTHFR. 30 to 50% of people already are born genetically with a subfunctional MTHFR. Methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase is the name of that enzyme. So when it comes to breast cancer, you have to think of what's a drink. 12 ounces of beer equals 5 ounces of wine equals 1.5 ounces of hard liquor, like whiskey, gin, vodka. A drink a day will increase breast cancer by 10%. Two drinks a day, 20 to 30%, three drinks a day, 40%, and upwards and onwards from there. So the best solution is to not drink. But if you enjoy drinking, which many people obviously do, the literature out there on it being cardioprotective, heart healthy, is debatable. But you mentioned red wine. There are some redemptive properties of red wine. Even the American Cancer Society says, if you choose to drink, women should keep it to no more than one a day, men two a day. And I would say a caveat to that is if you choose to drink, choose red wine. Of all the alcoholic choices, red wine has resveratrol, which is a potent antioxidant that's actually being studied as a cancer weapon to give in treatments. And it also, this is our theme, I guess, is aromatase. It's also an aromatase inhibitor. So at 4 to 8 ounces of consumption, not less and not more than that in a given day, you will get aromatase inhibition to lower estrogen levels. And finally, if you are choosing to drink on any given day, I would supplement with methylfolate, with the thing that the alcohol is preventing your body from creating. So methylfolate, 800 micrograms a day. I'm partial to one that we've created, a formulation called Cosmo Companion that actually has botanicals that protect and support your liver as you detoxify alcohol, and it accelerates glucose metabolism and has B6 and B12 in it too. But ultimately, that's the skinny on it. The thing is the percentages. So I said a drink a day increases breast cancer by 10%. We have to think in absolute numbers. Percentages are super tricky for the lay public to understand in terms of what's thought of as absolute risk. For example, if you are 50 years old, the chances of you getting breast cancer in the next 10 years are 1 in 42. 1 in 42, 50-somethings will get breast cancer by age 60. If you have a drink a day and that increases it by 10%, that's 1.1 in 42 women will get breast cancer in this decade. So when you put those risks in perspective, especially if we're just talking about a celebratory birthday or holiday glass here and there, it really has no effect on your breast cancer risk. But daily drinking of, you know, one plus glasses is going to tip your percentages higher.
You know, I've been flummoxed a bit by the literature on coffee and cancer. There are more than a few studies that say that or indicate that coffee can significantly reduce the risk of breast cancer and also other forms of cancer. But they find that is so in lean women, paradoxically, drinking the same amount of coffee seems to increase the risk of breast cancer in obese women. Christy, can you help us unravel this issue of the coffee cancer connection?
I can, and I cannot, because even the science has not. But I'll tell you, so there's some protective effect about being overweight in your premenopausal years. And they think it has something to do with the connection between fat and weight and the ovary and the ovarian function. So paradoxically, although it's a lot of coffee, we're talking 5 to 6 cups of coffee a day in lean or normal weight women actually decreases breast cancer, even amongst those with BRCA mutations, I might add. There was a study looking at BRCA carriers. One study identified a 69% cancer reduction in those drinking 6 cups of coffee a day. But a Norwegian study said that those same 5 to 6, 5 cups it was in this, that reduced the risk of breast cancer in lean women in half, doubled the cancer risk in relatively obese women. So the authors there thought that methyl xanthines in coffee might have interfered with what I just briefly mentioned was the protective interaction postulated between premenopausal obesity and the ovary. And because it interferes with that protection, now the cancer skyrockets. Actually was another study in looking at this issue in 35,000 Chinese women that found that coffee intake doubled the development of advanced breast cancer, but only among heavier women with a body mass index greater than 23, which, by the way, would be normal weight for Americans who consider up to 24.9 normal weight. So that's the connection. For the majority, coffee is totally fine. It might cause breast pain, breast cysts, breast swelling. So if coffee bugs your breasts, don't have it. But if you're of normal weight, coffee's fine, maybe even protective. But if you're overweight, avoid it.
Well, thank you for that clarity. Sometimes when we get into the weeds and discuss these details, people can feel overwhelmed. They may not follow the data as closely as you or I do. They may feel that the numbers are just jarring in some way. And when faced with the amount of controversy and complexity that's involved in serious study of these things, they can throw up their hands and think, well, scientists are changing their mind every 3 days. And one day they say this and the next day they say that. It's just too much. I think I'm going to eat what it tastes good. and they kind of default to what society has normalized, which unfortunately is very toxic. How can we address that problem in folks? I mean, how can we help them simplify it, not to the sense that we're oversimplifying and reducing the clarity, but in the sense that it makes it available, accessible, and useful to people?
I think we do two things. One, we remind them of the overarching goodness of just trending toward whole food plant-based eating will absolutely have a cellular benefit and affect all aspects of your body and health, from your skin to your breasts to your bowel movements. And there can't be an over vilification of the way people are already eating, but gentle suggestions for substitution or for adding. It's harder for people to take something away than it is for them to add. So let me look at your plate. Oh, okay. I see you've got a chicken breast there and some mashed potatoes. How about we do a big side salad or a bunch of roasted broccoli with the raw broccoli thrown on top, right? You add to it to create strategic side dishes that can help nullify some of the negative cellular reactions that are going to happen to consuming these animal products. Majority of people are not going to turn on a dime and just 180 it and throw away everything in their fridge. Frankly, the way I did with my three sons at the time, we just boop in an instant turned around and went vegan. But one study I love that reinforces what I was initially saying in my answer is you want to create that overarching reminder of how beneficial this eating is. Took 100 men and women and gave them a standard American diet for breakfast, like pancakes and bacon, steak and eggs, and it measured their oxidized LDL cholesterol hourly as a marker of oxidative stress, of inflammation, of all the badness that can happen cellularly, that over time, week after week, after year, after decade, becomes a level of stress that a cell can't handle and it breaks. A breast cell turns into a breast cancer. Atherosclerotic plaque builds up enough to just squeeze that blood flow so low that boom, heart attack or stroke, etc. Okay, so bad actor LDL oxidized cholesterol, measured it hourly, up, 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 lunch, hamburger and fries, up, 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 dinner. Okay, these people are going to bed every single night after night after night with fewer antioxidants, which only come from plants, than when they woke up. Same people, next day, same sad standard American diet meal, one change, a cup of strawberries. Pancakes and bacon, cup of strawberries, oxidized LDL, up, 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 down, down, baseline. Lunch, hamburger and fries, one cup of strawberries. Up, 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 down, 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 baseline. What? The power in just a cup of strawberries, which is super fabulous among fruits, but not even the super fruitiest of the super fruits. One cup of strawberries could nullify all of that negative inflammation, estrogen promoting, growth screaming reaction from a hamburger and fries. What if the meal had been steel cut oats and blueberries with a little bit of flaxseed and cinnamon on it? The plaque in arteries melts away. The heart attack that was looming will never see the light of day. Those breast cancer cells that were just trying to form a mass that was starting to bring new blood flow recruits, squelched, dead in their tracks. So you remind people, this is the power of eating. And you don't vilify what they're eating right now. You make gentle suggestions on how to add more plants and slowly start subtracting the animals.
A lot of us have made mistakes. We've eaten poorly. We've done the thing that provided immediate gratification, that helped us cope, that helped us deal with the stress of our lives. And maybe we're experiencing some of the negative consequences of that. And the fact, the power of plants is such, so great that by eating healthfully, we can actually reverse some of the problems that we've caused ourselves. So we can get the forgiveness for our sins, if you want to use that type of language. To me, that's a really powerful reality that we're not victims here. We actually have a lot more control over what our health outcome will be going forward than we realize, even when we have eaten poorly and done other things in the past that maybe weren't well advised.
I have a study that I keep in my back pocket specifically for that moment when I'm face to face with a breast cancer patient. We're just figuring out what to do and how to attack this. And she looks at me, let's say she's 68 years old and on the plump side and drinks every night, or often drinks too much, say, "Doc, I hear what you're saying, but come on, look at me. It's too late for me." And then I say, "Oh no, sister, let me tell you a story of a study that took 50 obese women. They didn't have breast cancer. They just were overweight, didn't exercise enough. And they took their blood and they measured IGF-1. Remember, insulin-like growth factor, that big daddy growth promoter, the biggest of them all inside our bloodstreams. They measured the binding protein for IGF-1, which snatches it out of circulation. And they took that blood and dripped it on a petri dish with a fresh grafting of human breast cancer cells. And a few cells died because everyone alive has some cancer-fighting immune system cells working on their behalf. All right, so they go away, these ladies, with a plan. It's called the Pritikin plan, a low-fat, high-fiber diet with daily exercise and no animal protein. So you've got a whole food plant-based diet, high fiber, low fat, daily exercise, we're talking 30 minutes a day. And for some of these women, it's sauntering as quickly as they can. They came back how long later? And this is the key, 12 days later, less than 2 weeks later, we draw the blood. I didn't have anything to do with the study, by the way. They drew the blood. IGF-1 levels, boom, plummeted. The binding protein, shoo, skyrocketed. New blood sample on a fresh petri dish with human breast cancer cells, drip that blood, and whew, the majority of the cells disappeared on the spot. So please don't ever tell me it is too late for you, because in less than 2 weeks, I can transform your blood into a cancer-kicking machine.
So a whole foods plant-based diet really is the optimal way to address breast cancer risk. And I hear you saying again and again that every single day we make countless choices that either bring us closer to cancer or move us further away from it. That the way we eat can either fuel cancer cells or help our bodies to seek them out and destroy them. And that when we eat a whole, colorful plant food diet, we help our bodies to defend themselves against these risks. And we get the optimal experience of living in our bodies, the most vitality, the most energy, the most clarity of mind, and the most joy. Christy, it's been a pleasure for me today to speak with you, as it always is. And on behalf of Ocean and myself and everyone involved in the food revolution, I thank you. I thank you for your outstanding work, for your deep caring, and of course, for being with us today.
And I thank both of you for allowing my voice to be heard and to share your message. Thank you.
We have been talking with the brilliant Dr. Christy Funk, founder of the Pink Lotus Breast Center and author of Breasts, an Owner's Manual. Christy, you rock. We thank you so much for your brilliant insights, for your wise guidance, for your eloquent passion, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
I wish you the breast of health.
Thank you.